Welcome to a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, coming to you from San Francisco. Our program is supported by listeners like you, and if you can help, I'd appreciate it. Helps cover the costs of starting up this podcast series. I want to thank Joe Carson of Knoxville, Tennessee, a true whistleblower in his own right, who decided to support our program after hearing some of our interviews in the Boiling Frog series with Sybelle Edmonds. And what you're about to hear is the 12th installment in the Boiling Frog series. And this is especially timely in view of President Obama's decision to commit more American forces to Afghanistan. Joe Lauria is a journalist and foreign affairs correspondent who has covered the United Nations for 19 years. And from that post, he offers fascinating commentary on the recent bungled elections in Afghanistan and the role of Peter Galbraith, an American. And a lot more, too. I'd like to invite you, if you haven't already, to also listen to podcast number 68 with Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, who understand the history of Afghanistan perhaps better than any journalists that we've talked to recently. Thanks for listening to the Boiling Frog series and the Peter B. Collins Show. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the fight is fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. But today, NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling? Welcome to the Boiling Frogs.
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs with Sybelle Edmonds. I'm Peter B. Collins. And our guest today is journalist Joe Lauria. He's an independent reporter based in New York City, and he has been a freelance correspondent for the Boston Globe at the United Nations. He blogs at the Huffington Post, and he has written for many great publications, too numerous to name. He also is the co-author with former Senator Mike Gravel of the book called A Political Odyssey, The Rise of American Militarism and One Man's Fight to Stop It. Joe Lauria, welcome to the Boiling Frogs today.
Thank you for inviting me, Peter.
Well, it's great to talk with you, and we have some important issues to talk about and get your take on. And I want to start in Afghanistan because I struggle with the right language, but it's satisfying now that there is at least a debate underway in this country about what to do with the U.S. forces that are in Afghanistan, what the mission is. I think that's a very fuzzy situation right there. And when President Obama took office, he was acting on a campaign promise to put more troops into Afghanistan, which he did in the first quarter of this year. And now we have General McChrystal's report asking for additional troop commitments. And it is, again, important for me that we're seeing strong voices speak up on all sides of this issue. Let's start with the recent election that was held at the end of August. And just in the past week or so here in mid-October, the United Nations has definitively released a report. There's also an election commission there in Afghanistan that conducted an investigation. And President Hamid Karzai has accepted that the results from the previous election were fraudulent, or at least were riddled with fraud. And he has agreed to a runoff, which may occur in early November. What are your comments about this election process and where we are today?
Well, they've set the date for the runoff of November 7th, which is not too far down the road. The ballots are supposedly all printed up already. Preparations are being made now to provide security, get election monitors out there from the European Union, some from the U.S. The U.N. is not monitoring its election. There's a lot of confusion about the actual mission the U.N. had out there, and they've done a very poor job explaining what their role has been, and that led to this very public row between the head of the mission, Kai Eide, a Norwegian diplomat, and his deputy, Peter Galbraith, an American former ambassador to Croatia. And that was always going to be a testy situation to have a powerful American in a number two spot at the UN. And what's happened now is Karzai very reluctantly agreed to this runoff. He actually did not accept that there was fraud, but he said, for the good of the country, et cetera, mm-hmm. he would, in fact, agree to this runoff. He knows very well that there was many ghost polling stations where they never even set up a polling booth. But hundreds and thousands of votes were counted from those areas. And this is what Galbraith, the number two in the UN mission, had been warning about and said publicly, because his boss was refusing to make this public or to make any move about the intelligence that they had, that these voting booths weren't even set up, and that there were other... These are Pashtun areas, Taliban-controlled, extremely dangerous, where a lot of voters probably wouldn't go out mm-hmm. to vote anyway, so... One argument that Galbraith was putting, this is the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, by the way, the famous economist, former JFK administration official, that they should never even set it up at all and shut it down and not counted any votes. So we're going to see if that plays itself, how that's going to play itself out now. And in fact, they've decided they're going to shut down partially some of these ghost polling stations in these dangerous areas. And they're going to try to fire some of the 200 election officials that were involved in the fraud. Now, there are two bodies we have to, if you really want to get into the details, is the election council, which is set up by the Afghan government.
Mm-hmm.
They're all appointees of Karzai. And these guys obviously were involved in the fraud. And that could be troublesome again. Then there's the Electoral Complaints Commission. And the Electoral Complaints Commission was appointed partially by the UN. So those guys were the ones who, in the end, decided that this was a fraud, and Karzai had to agree. Now, there's another possibility that could work itself out. The number two guy in the runoff in the August election, who will now be in the runoff against Karzai, is Abdullah, and he and Karzai might actually form a coalition government before the November 7th election. There's some pressure being put on him by both parties, rather, by the Americans, by the UN. To avoid this very tricky election for security reasons, and also because it's snowing already in the mountains around Afghanistan, mm-hmm. so it's going to be very difficult.
Now, Joe, as you earlier pointed out, you said the ballots have already been printed, and the cynic in me suggests that some ballot yeah. boxes have already been stuffed, and that there may even be a projection of victory in the Karzai camp. Yet we hear that, for example, Secretary of State Clinton, while pushing for this runoff election, has also indicated that she expects Karzai to win.
Right.
And so it strikes me that while we're hardly paragons of virtue when it comes to untainted elections, particularly presidential elections,
right.
that it's hard to confer credibility on any electoral process in Afghanistan under the current regime.
Well, I mean, that's quite a reasonable position to take. She said that because the feeling is that he won 48% and Abdullah won 31%, and the other parties who drop out, of course, in the second round, most of those voters are going to go over to Karzai. So since he already had a lead, even without the fraud, he won the election with the fraud. Because when these votes were taken away, that he no longer had the 50% margin that he needed to win outright. This is what's causing the runoff. So given the fact that he got close to the 50% and these other parties have to pull out are for him and that he already had a large margin, it's being assumed that even without fraud, Karzai will probably win. And he would be smart to call off the dogs and not have these guys go out and stuff the ballot boxes and win outright. That's probably the smartest thing to do. Actually, the best thing for the country, or let's say the part of the country that's not Taliban-controlled, is to have this coalition government. But that's really not a government of unity without the Taliban. Until there's negotiations with the Taliban, there's no chance for any kind of a political settlement or peace in Afghanistan, and nobody's talking about that. So the whole thing, as you say, if only parts of the country are voting, and we've got a guy who obviously cheated the first time, and if he wins again, there's always going to be hanging over the doubt that he cheat again. It's not an ideal situation. I don't think anybody's saying that it is.
I have a question on Galbraith. I have been talking to some people, and I've been getting mixed the descriptions and also a portrait of Galbraith, depending on who I talk with, because some people consider him this, oh, great, brave whistleblower and someone who deserves the title of whistleblower. And other people, they're saying that, well, his motives may be murkier and that his background should be raising a little bit of eyebrow or give people a benefit of doubt in terms of who he really is. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, he's an American diplomat. As I said, he's the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, and he was the American ambassador to Croatia during the war, played a pivotal role there. Out of government, because he's a Democrat, he said this in print, I assume it's true, that he went to brief Bush at the White House before the invasion of Iraq, about the various parties in Iraq, because he has experience there in Iraq as well, and in Yugoslavia. And he told Bush that he explained that they were Shiites and that they were Sunnis in Iraq and Kurds. And Bush apparently said, I thought they were Muslims. So this is one of Galbraith's stories. He gave that story in print. He knew Kai Idi from 20 years ago when they worked together in Kosovo. Idi for the UN. In fact, Kai Idi, a Norwegian, introduced Galbraith to his wife, who also was a Norwegian. So they were quite close. He joined this mission as the number two, there were rumblings here in the UN that this wasn't going to work out. First of all, Galbraith is an American, and Americans on UN missions are always very tricky. If you come from the most powerful country, it's hard not to act in a way where you have that country behind you. Now, if you're a UN official, you're not allowed to even speak to members of your own government, but everybody knows that he's very close friends with Holbrooke. I'm not saying here that I know for sure that he ever discussed with Holbrooke Afghanistan. Maybe he didn't. He's not supposed to. But there was always a suspicion that maybe he was doing the bidding of the Americans and not just being a neutral UN official. However, once he began to speak out, here's to answer your questions about whether he was a whistleblower or not, the Americans went very silent on him. Holbrooke said nothing. Hillary Clinton didn't defend him. What he did was he saw this evidence of fraud early on in the process. And he went to his boss, his friend, Kai Idi, the Norwegian, and said, we have to do something about this. Now, technically, under the rules that the UN was engaged in, they're only there to assist the Afghan authorities to run the election. They're not even supposed to, under their mandate, turn over evidence of fraud to this Electoral Complaints Commission, upon which several members are appointed by the UN. They're supposed to just sit on this, which is an absurd situation, but that's what they came to. And it turns out that Kai Idi first said that he couldn't turn over any evidence, and they didn't have any evidence. Then it leaked out, and was actually admitted in a press conference by his officials here in New York, that they sent out their own private UN monitors, not to monitor, but just to gather intelligence for Kai Idi so that he could deal better with the Afghan officials. And then he admitted in his press conference in Kabul a couple of weeks ago that he, in fact, did turn over some that he could verify. So it was the way the UN handled the PR side that made it so messy. And Galbraith comes out looking like he was right, that there was fraud, that these polling stations were fraudulent. The results, a lot of them were never opened. So the issue was, I think the essence of it was, you wanted him to turn over this data. Kai Idi wasn't turning it over. Was he doing that to ensure a Karzai victory? Was he trying to be neutral? Was Galbraith really pushing from the American side that they wanted Karzai out? I personally think the administration has not made up its mind, at least at that point, about what they thought of Karzai. They still haven't made up their mind about the troops. I think they're doing a review of an incredibly complex situation where there's no good answer whatsoever in Afghanistan. If they're really going to, by their own army manual I was just reading, they would need 800,000 troops for a population of 32 million to fight an insurgency. And that's obviously not going to happen. So why bother having 40,000 more troops there? Mm-hmm. It's a dreadful situation, and Obama's, every day he doesn't make a decision, the Republicans are calling him out on that. And this is again, a mess that he inherited as well. So I think in terms of Galbraith, yes, he accused them of a cover-up. They denied it. They also accused him, the UN did, of wanting to annul the election altogether, the first round, and install Ashraf Ghani, who was a former World Bank economist, an Afghani, as the president. And that's why they fired him, that he wanted to do something unconstitutional, set up his own government there. Now, I don't know if that's true. If that is, this is not a very good motive for Gelbert. It wasn't just to ensure a free election. He maybe wanted to kick them both out, even though there really was fraud, to get his own guy in there. And then a story emerged in the Financial Times last week, this is just to finish on him, that he has been a big advocate of Kurdish interests in northern Iraq for some time, and he has big investments in a Kurdish oil company there as well. So his own personal interests were tied to some of his political, and he admitted that that was true. It was a Financial Times story. No one's pure in this story, but I think he's certainly been vindicated. At the end of the day, there was fraud, and maybe if he hadn't spoken up, this may not have happened, that there would be a second round. Maybe Karzai would have won. We don't know that.
And, Joe, with your expertise in covering the United Nations for a long time, could you give us your sense of the interplay here? Because Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General, sided with Kai Eide in terms of what I consider to be a kind of squishy response. Now, you pointed out that the UN mandate wasn't to monitor for fraud, and right. So this put them in a difficult spot. But, you know, if I'm sent to do one thing and I observe a crime being committed, I think most people would agree that you have an obligation to report it. Now, the United Nations is in a very difficult spot, and the practice of diplomacy is something that I do understand is complicated, and you often have to soften your positions or soft pedal the truth in order to keep the very many disparate parties mollified. But that said, what are the inner workings of the UN? And you pointed out that having an American in a secondary position, a number two position, is almost problematic on the face of it.
Yeah, especially a guy like Gelbert, who's very opinionated and forceful personality. I mean, the head of the Department of Political Affairs for the first time in UN history is an American, a man by the name of Lynn Pashko. He was a former U.S. ambassador to Indonesia, but he's not a strong personality. He's a retired diplomat. Sometimes he seems less than fully engaged. I hope he's not listening to this. He'll be very angry if he doesn't say this. But he's a good guy. And he, at the beginning, I remember doing an interview with the South African ambassador and others, and I wrote a story about this, that people were worried that the Americans were going to be running political affairs. This was a Bush idea and a Bolton idea, and everybody thought it was a nefarious thing. It turned out that it doesn't look like that he was pushing the Bush agenda at all, and he's certainly not pushing the Obama agenda. So it depends on the personality. But, I mean, as far as Ban Ki-moon here, I chuckled when you said his name, and maybe you didn't hear me, but he's such a weak character here. He has so little respect, I'm sorry to say, from all the members of the UN, really. He was what they wanted, a weak Secretary General who could be made not to stand in the way of the big power interests.
And forgive me, who were they? John Bolton?
Yeah, Bolton, certainly. The Americans, the French, the British, the Russians, and the Chinese, the five permanent members, the five nuclear powers, the five largest arms sellers in the world. These are the five permanent members of the Security Council. They have veto power. The Security Council is the one UN body that really can have practical effect. It can authorize a war, could stop an authorization of a war like Iraq, and the Americans will go ahead and do it anyway. But they got together and decided on Ban Ki-moon. They have to agree, the five. And once that happens, they pretty much get it through the rest of the Security Council, and the General Assembly rubber stamps it. So after Kofi Annan, who was a very charismatic and strong figure, probably the most outspoken Secretary General since Dag Hammarskjöld in the 60s, the Americans, in particular, the Bush administration, did not want anybody remotely like that. Kofi Annan, he was pressed by the BBC and said that the invasion of Iraq was illegal, precisely because the Security Council had not approved it, and the UN Charter makes it clear that it's against international law if an operation of that type is not approved by the Security Council. So he was technically correct in saying it was an illegal invasion by the United States, but it was during the election campaign that he said it, and the Americans accused him of favoring the Democrats. It was, that would have been John Kerry at the time, that election. They made sure, Bolton and the others, particular Bolton, the Americans, that we would have a man who was, as he says, more a secretary than a general. But it turns out Ban Ki-moon sees himself as a Dag Hammarskjöld figure, but the man just doesn't have the tools. He doesn't have the charisma. He doesn't have the force of personality. He's very earnest and very sincere, and not a whiff of corruption around him where there was around Kofi Annan. He's not really a guy to be necessarily reckoned with on a situation like this. He backed Kayyade because Kayyade is his man, and he would not step forward and say, "Well, wait a minute, we got to listen to Gilbert because this is important." And again, look at the situation. He's not in Afghanistan. He doesn't know what was going on there. And they were waiting maybe for the Americans. I was just speaking to an Egyptian diplomat who was telling me her view was that the Americans had not made clear whether they were ready to dump Karzai, whether they really wanted him to win, whether they were going to make an issue of the fraud or not. And Gilbert came forward on his own as a UN official to make an issue of it. So there was no signal from the U.S. And I think Ban Ki-moon was waiting for a signal from the U.S. So he just went with his own man, and the Americans were quiet about Gilbert, let him out to hang to dry because he was a UN official, not one of theirs. And Ban Ki-moon, you know, had him axed. That's what Kayyade wanted. But at the end of the day, there's a second round because there was fraud, and that's what Gilbert was talking about. It was fraud.
Joe, let's talk about the recent report on Taliban's funding and the conflicting reports on the role of drugs, heroin, Taliban's funding.
UN, just today, a few hours ago, was released. It was embargoed. And I interviewed Antonio Maria Costa. He's the head of the UN Drugs and Crime Organization based in Vienna, and he's quite an engaging character. He's sort of the UN's drug czar. And he told me, he's made this remark before, but he made it specifically to me today about the Taliban, because I asked him about the role of banks, Western banks, in laundering drug money, and taking drug laundered money and not asking too many questions. And he says, in a time of severe recession like we're going through now, in this liquidity crisis, banks are undercapitalized. They're looking for dough. They're even less likely to want to ask too many questions about where this money is coming from. And a lot of this money is coming from sales of opium from Afghanistan, where it supplies 90 or 95% of the world's supply of opium. Heroin comes from Afghanistan. And so that money is filtering into the banking system, and it's encouraging and helping the Taliban to fund itself. And you could look at it from an American point of view purely, that they're killing American soldiers and maybe American banks and European banks. He didn't name any banks, so I don't know which banks he's talking about. American banks and European banks are in a way indirectly helping to fund the guys killing American soldiers. And then there's the addicts, mostly in Europe. There's very little heroin use in the U.S. It's mostly in Europe. And Russia in particular, and Iran. Yeah, and Iran has got a severe, severe problem of heroin addiction. And that's coming in through the other side from the Afghan border. He was telling me how they built a trench about 10 feet wide and about 10 feet deep all along the border, like a Maginot line. They're trying to build a trench between Afghanistan and Iran just to prevent heroin from being smuggled into Iran. But it's the addicts in the West who are victims, and they need help. But they create the demand for the drugs to be sold, and they are helping to fund the Taliban. So we also have, of course, the corruption of officials. And he was telling me it's not just the customs official and the policeman, but accountants and lawyers and a slew of white-collar official civilian and private sector people who are facilitating sales of equipment to Afghanistan, where they're now setting up labs. Mostly a Turkish operation before where this heroin was being processed, but they're doing it inside Afghanistan now as well, and they're buying the equipment that's being sold by private companies into Afghanistan. So it's $700 million a year, at least, in drug money is being funded that the Taliban earns from drugs, and it's killing more people in Russia from overdoses than per year than Russians died during their invasion of Afghanistan. In a yearly basis, fewer Russians died in the war in Afghanistan per annum than our Russian civilians and citizens are dying now from overdosing on heroin. And that's the same with NATO. There are more young kids and heroin addicts dying in NATO countries than NATO soldiers are dying. So they're fighting to stop the Taliban, but they're actually dying in greater numbers because of the drug problem. That's helped, without question, being facilitated by white-collar crime, by banks, and by heroin addicts in the West. That's the import. Now, the funding issue, though, the New York Times had a report on Monday, an interesting story, something that I've been questioning, where is the Taliban funded? It turns out that the drug money is not the largest single source of their income. It is individuals who are given donations from Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, and the Pakistani intelligence services, the ISI, still to some extent, and other donations. So they're raising money. They have fundraisers. They're constantly raising money. So it's the drug money almost supplements. And McChrystal was quoted as saying, if we eliminated the heroin trade in Afghanistan, it would only interfere with their operations, but they wouldn't put an end to the Taliban's funding. Nonetheless, the drug issue is a serious one, and that was the report that came out today.
Joe, based on several reports, they are talking about only about 10% of this heroin revenue going to Taliban, and they only indicate that 90% of it goes to other operators in other nations. And nobody really talks about these other nations. You know, there's talk about Pakistan, of course, you just mentioned Turkey, but there is no mentioning of these other nations where 90% of these revenues of heroin goes to. Do you have any comments on that?
You mean where the heroin product goes and is consumed?
No, in terms of the value of heroin is right now estimated to be around $40 to $50 billion. They're talking about the street value of Afghan sourced heroin, and they're saying about approximately 10% of it goes to the warlords, the Taliban, you know, the corrupt government officials, including Karzai brothers, etc., but that 90% of it, both the revenue and operations, involved other foreign countries that are involved with Afghanistan. And they are never named. That's the very interesting thing, because when you look at the South America reports or Mexico reports, you have the names of the various groups and gangs and countries, organizations, the operatives, operations groups involved. But with Afghanistan heroin, and whether it's the State Department's report or other reports, they are only mentioned as other involved foreign nations, and it's just left at that instead of being named.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking, as you're speaking, and I'm glad you were speaking a long time because it gave me more time to look this up in the report. I see that Myanmar certainly was the leading nation before Afghanistan. I think still some opium comes from there. And the profits are being made by organized crime in Russia to a great extent. And I don't know the other countries where this profit is going. I didn't realize it was 90%. So you just said that.
Correct.
That is,
according to the report, and until 2001, until we invaded Afghanistan, Russians were the major players in Afghan heroin, again, together with Turks. But after our invasions, Russians' share has declined drastically. So, and as we know from various research and studies and academic books published, Pakistan ISI used those revenue to fund a lot of their operations. So Pakistan's involvement has been quite well known. But then again, as I said, I just find it interesting that other nations are not mentioned.
Yeah. Well, as I said, Iran has a big market, and Russia have the two biggest markets. Scotland, believe it or not, has got a huge market for heroin. So the dealers in these countries presumably are making money. I mean, who the middlemen are, I think Turkey still plays a big role, now in Afghanistan to some extent, and I think Pakistan too. But and another thing this report said, just to change quickly, is that the rest of Central Asia is being infected with this. Drug money is now being funneled into other parts of Central Asia to fund insurgents there. So this is one of the things the report is showing, that this is becoming a new phenomenon, that drug money is being profits are being used to fund insurgencies in the other Central Asian nations around and north of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Now, Joe, when we talk about who's funding the Taliban, I think it's important to parse for people the different elements of the Taliban, because particularly the television media in this country just try to portray it as if this is a militarized group that is under the command and control of Mullah Omar, and that it's, you know, a fairly distinct, identifiable mass of individuals. But we know that there are at least three factions that comprise the Afghan Taliban. We know that the Taliban originally was started by Pakistan's intelligence operation, the ISI. And so I'm wondering, as you look at these sources of funding, for example, is Hekmatyar the primary conduit for drug money? Because I would think that Mullah Omar, if we are to believe his reputation as an Islamic fundamentalist cleric, wouldn't be dabbling in that, or maybe we just have the wrong perception of him.
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I would be not surprised if he was dabbling in it. There was 1 year where the Taliban eliminated. I think it was 2001. Was it
In May of 2001, I believe we sent a bonus check of $100 million to the Taliban government in Kabul as a reward for their crackdown on the output of heroin.
Yeah, I asked Maria Costa today, the head of the UN drug agency, and he said that was a function of the market. The price had gone too low because it was flooded, and they simply cut back for a year to increase, and they kept selling off their stocks. They had an oversupply. There was an overproduction of opium, so they stopped producing for about a year. The only little bit that was produced in the country was in the Northern Alliance area in the north of Afghanistan, and that's the reason why that was cut down. So it's not any this religious stuff. Unfortunately, with a lot of like most extreme religious people, there's usually the other side of that is the other side of that coin is hypocrisy. So I would the idea that they don't want to do heroin because they're religious is maybe they don't drink alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
But the opium is being used a little bit more in Afghanistan than before, but it's not the big consumer nation. They're just selling it. You know, they're selling it to infidels, I guess,
mm-hmm.
Russia.
Now, what about the Massoud faction of the Taliban, which is based in Pakistan? Where do they get their money? Do we know?
Yeah, from the Americans somehow. No, through the ISI.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of that money that we've sent over, the U.S. has sent over to Musharraf in particular, He admitted, I think about a month or so ago, that he indeed used a lot of that money to build his defenses against the Indians and not to fight the Taliban. So, I don't know that study. I presume that money is going over this border. And I'm glad you're raising this issue of Pakistani and the Afghani Taliban, because it's quite interesting, this Durand line, Mortimer Durand being a foreign secretary of British India, in 1893, set down this line that would show where British interests stopped and where Afghanistan interests were. And that line became the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, where Pakistan became an independent country in 1947. Afghanistan has never recognized that border. It's still is not recognized by the Pashtuns on either side. I mean, there has been movements for Pashtun nationhood. In the 70s in particular, it was strong. And Afghanistan lost that part of Pakistan where the Taliban live now, like Waziristan, federal administered tribal areas, the northwest frontier provinces. That was all part of Afghanistan until the late 19th century when the British took it and incorporated it into British India. And then when said 50 years later, when Pakistan was formed, it became part of Pakistan. But it was really originally part of Afghanistan for a long time, and they want, because they're Pashtuns, and Afghanistan has wanted it back, previous governments. They're not talking about that now, but that is an underlying conflict still. This unrecognized border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, that's one people they're moving back and forth. And we have to look at it that way, I think. The mm-hmm. Taliban is maybe not the best representative of the Pashtun people. No one talks about Pashtun nationalism in the current time, and even the Pashtuns are not really agitating for it. But it would seem to me that one solution that you might want to explore is if there was a legitimate Pashtun nationalist movement that did not like the Taliban representing them and their brand of religious extremism and violence and targeting civilians and using terror, and that they could perhaps, just the way they turned the Sunni tribesmen against al-Qaeda inside Iraq, there's talk about trying to... Now they talk about Taliban with a small T, moderate Taliban, but I'm talking about Taliban at all. I'm talking about Pashtuns and a Pashtun party. But neither Pakistan does not want to lose that territory, even the headache that it is. And I don't think Afghanistan would like to see, obviously, a independent Pashtunistan, even though the headache that it is to them. But that's something that nobody's even talking about. It's just one thing that I've raised on my own. I'm just thinking why it is not even considered as an option, because that movement isn't really, it's kind of dormant right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we're stuck with this violent Taliban, which is somebody you still have to deal with and they're going to have to negotiate with. And, you know, if the Americans pulled out and NATO pulled out, it's very likely they could take over the country again. Then we'd go back to where we were before 2002. And then the issue is, does Al-Qaeda have to set up there, or can they set up somewhere else? And how much of a threat really is Al-Qaeda? I mean, these are all of the questions
mm-hmm.
surrounding the tough decision that Obama's trying to make about what to do.
Joe, on October 18th, the New York Times Sunday Magazine featured a lengthy story, mostly about General Stanley McChrystal, who is in charge of our troops in Afghanistan. Dexter Filkins wrote it, and I had an opportunity to interview the photographer who supplied the photographs for the magazine piece, and there's also a very interesting slideshow with more photos that's up at the New York Times website. The photographer's name is Peter Van Ogdmel, and something struck me as you were just talking a moment ago, that McChrystal does demonstrate, I think, a sensitivity to the civilian population in Afghanistan. He's articulated the need for fewer aerial strikes and a much more careful use of drones. And so he's very aware of the footprint of an occupying force. The two things that Filkins didn't cover and that McChrystal doesn't talk about in this lengthy piece are the influence of drugs and drug money, and also the role of military contractors in our presence in Afghanistan. I just wonder if you have comments about either of those subjects and what you thought of the Filkins story.
I did not read it, so I can't comment on
okay.
that. But I just spoke at some length about the drugs. You know, there's a theory out there that that the West, the Americans, want this drug money to be flowing into the economy now. I asked that of Costa. He thinks that's not true. I don't think it's true either. So they would like to stamp that out, or if, you know, because it funds the Taliban, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the military contractors, well, wherever there's a U.S. military operation, the more and more privatized American military operations become, we have these bloody contractors that are sucking taxpayers' money out, that the Army used to do these jobs probably a lot more cost-efficiently before. And the whole thing is politically fraught back in Washington, the lobbying that they do, and who knows what relationship they have to congressmen, to administration, certainly the last administration. It's an ugly situation. And if their business is war, you know, you make money from war, obviously you don't want it to end. So they're probably lobbying furiously right now. I mean, Sabella lives in Washington. I don't. People may know this. I mean, to send another 40,000 or 60,000 troops, because they're going to need more support from the private contractors. An ugly business. If it's publicly funded, as an army is, and the responsible politicians and leaders do not want to spend the people's money because they can get booted out of office, they may be more reluctant. But when there's private contractors going on here, they're making profit. Well, I mean, who are they answering to? They're shareholders, and they want more and more profit, so they're going to lobby for these extra troops. The horrible pressure, I think, to be put on decision makers in the administration, on Obama, and I would think that's a very not a good situation there. I don't think there have been as high profile crimes committed in Afghanistan as we saw in Iraq, where they were literally shooting people going down the street, like the Japanese in Manchuria. I mean, it was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And finally, the Iraqis put some of those guys on trial. So I haven't seen that kind of thing. Well, maybe that has happened. I'm just not aware of it. But it can't be a good thing wherever you see private military contracts going on.
Yeah.
Anywhere where the U.S. forces are.
Now, Joe, on the very day that President Obama was notified that he's been selected to win the Nobel Peace Prize, a few hours later he went into a meeting with his war council. And as, you know, you and I cannot, we can only guess what the discussions are. We have some reports, for example, that Vice President Biden is pushing to block any further troop increases. And while the president says that he's hearing from all sides, the one side that I don't think is represented is let's get the hell out of there altogether. And I do recognize that it's a complicated situation, that we are dug in, and you can't just send planes and bring the troops back tomorrow. At the same time, we need a reasonable path forward, and I don't see that we really are looking at all options, which would include a graceful withdrawal of some sorts. And what I fear is that we're going to hear from people who rarely talk about human rights, but particularly the Republican opponents of the administration, will start with scary stories about what the Taliban will do to women and girls in Afghanistan, and that we cannot possibly leave because we will create a human rights debacle. And I'd like to hear just what your response is to some of these arguments that are floating about today.
Well, you hit that nail on the head, obviously. If that's a political decision and he has to worry about, the Republicans will kill him. If the Taliban takes over, especially before the next election, presidential election, and starts to go back to their extremist ways and their absolutely horrible mistreatment of women and girls and their other extremist laws that they had there, that would be maybe political suicide for Obama. So in his calculations right now in the cabinet room, that's got to be going through his head. Certainly what Axelrod's probably talking to him about. That's unfortunate because the Republicans, one of them, wasn't it George Will who said we should get out, basically. So there's a couple of rational ones on that side, at least on this issue. They can't win. They're not going to put as many troops as they need to make it an armed camp. They shouldn't be there. I think it seems an occupation. They've got to find, as you say, a graceful way out of that, to have assistance, to build up. If you start to talk now to the Taliban while you still have troops there, try to find some way to have a real unity government and show that the U.S. doesn't want to occupy, and it's their oil and gas and their pipeline routes. And if you want to do business with them, even if the Taliban goes to government, you do try to do business with them. As you know, the Bush administration tried to do business with the Taliban and didn't come through. I mean, the UNICAL, which is a whole other story. And then that fell through. So I don't see how you can come to a political solution without including the Taliban in talks. And before they get too strong, I think then before the U.S. pulls out, this is the time to do that. And I think that could be a viable way for Obama to go forward. If he says, we're pulling out, we're going home, it looks like only Democrats suffer from that. Reagan pulled out of Lebanon when those Marines were killed, and yet he was a great hero. I don't get that.
Yeah.
But if Obama left, you could be sure the Republicans would nail him to the wall on that. So he has to start now, I think, to talk to all the parties in that country and try to reason with an extremist group. I mean, there's no good answer here.
And do you think out of the process that we'll get any greater clarity about the mission and about an exit strategy, however long-term it might be?
That's a damn good question. What is the mission? I mean, what kind of an Afghanistan does the United States and their NATO allies want to see? Do they want to see a consumer society and free and fair elections at all levels and private business and foreign investment there and living at peace with their neighbors? And I mean, this is a pipe dream, obviously. So what are they doing there? Are they trying to defeat the Taliban? When it was Al-Qaeda that did 9/11, and Al-Qaeda is not the Taliban. They're not Pashtuns. They're foreign fighters. It's not clear how many are even there anymore. They can set up anywhere they want to. They're an inflated threat. Let's face it. Al-Qaeda is not the threat that they're made out to be. The Taliban is not a threat to the United States. They're a threat to the Afghan people, and to women in particular, and that is something to stand up for. But if you can't defeat them militarily, then you got to admit that. And that this was a policy initiated by George Bush. And Obama, although he has said this since the primaries, that he wanted to carry out this war, because I think he needed a war. The American president seems to need one for some damn reason. And but he could say, look, I just come to the conclusion that the war Bush started, even though his motives may have been, prevent another 9/11, is just, it's not working. And we don't think Al-Qaeda was that present. That's one of the arguments going on now. And they're not even sure. Some people in the administration believe Al-Qaeda wouldn't set up there even if the Americans left. And Taliban is not a direct threat to the United States, as Saddam Hussein never was. And we can't be employing our assets like this and killing innocent civilians and killing American soldiers and making the private contractors rich, by the way. So we got to try something completely different. And I would think that would have to be talking to the Taliban and then eventually coming to some arrangement and pulling out gradually, supporting the Afghan national army where you have to integrate Taliban units and make it an Afghan country, make it Afghanistan again, not an American, not a British place, even if we have interest there in terms of controlling, having access to pipelines, the oil and gas, and in a world where these supplies are dwindling, and that's going to become more and more the focus, as we saw Brzezinski saying way back when, that Eurasia is where the future is. So, I mean, yeah, you do have to do deals with people as independent nations. If the U.S. could step back and say that they really wanted an independent Afghanistan with the Taliban included, I don't know if that's going to work. I'm not saying that it would, but I don't think you could send more troops. I don't think that's going to work. I think everybody knows that, and they're in denial about that. It's like kind of Vietnam-era denial, even though when Dan Ellsberg leaked the papers, we knew they were in that study saying they knew they were never going to win this war, and they were lying to everybody. That could be going on right now, too. It becomes a political decision to send men into harm's way and to kill more people because he will look like a weakling if he gives up. These are all the things going on right there now, but I obviously advocate getting out and building, trying to talk to Taliban and rolling the dice to see if that will work.
And Joe, to me, one of the greatest impediments is a guy named Robert Gates, who is the holdover Republican Secretary of Defense. And I think back to the feint that Bush played on the American people and the world with the Iraq Study Group of 4 years ago. And Gates was a member of that group. And then just a year after their report was published, the surge was underway. Rumsfeld resigns or is forced out the day after the 2006 elections. And here comes Bob Gates. And to me, unless we see a change at the Pentagon, I don't expect that we're going to see anything less than further escalation.
He's a really stealthy kind of defense secretary. He's certainly not Don Rumsfeld. He's playing a much lower profile. And you wonder whether his influence is any good. And I was just going through some of my paper archives, and I came across a Nation magazine article from the mid-'80s, and it was about Gates, CIA guy. And his role there in covert operations, and this was not a good guy from the point of view if you're a Democratic-loving person. And here he is, still, as you say, the holdover of the Bush administration running the Defense Department while he's not out there, you know, making outlandish statements and being a total egotist like Don Rumsfeld was. You wonder what his thinking is here. I mean, he has to know that they can't win this war. He's got to know better than any of us. Civilians out here just analyzing what's going on. I don't understand why he would tell Obama to listen to McChrystal and send the troops. I don't. McChrystal's doing it because he's the guy on the ground and he's more man to do his job. That's it. But the civilian head of the Pentagon, you know, is looking at this from the political point of view too, and he's got to see that that ain't the way forward. So I would agree. If Gates left, you know, Obama's the president. Excuse me. He's got to tell Gates, I disagree with you. And he's got to stand up for something and make a decision based on what he thinks is right. Based in the end of the day, maybe what's in his gut. That's more, maybe that's all that's left after you've done. Read every briefing paper there is and gotten every intelligence analyst to come to the Oval Office and debrief you, and brief you rather, that you have to make a decision based on what you think is the right thing to do. And we want to see him do that on health care, and we want to see him do that on Afghanistan now.
Well, in all of this, the most or one of the most important elements happens to be the role of the media and how the media is reporting on this issue, which brings us to the topic of where we are with the mainstream media and how you view the current sorry state of our mainstream media today.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, just yesterday, Columbia University, Leonard Downey Jr., the former executive editor of the Post, and a couple of other people released a study, and he announced that in the op-ed page of the Washington Post on Monday, and he's got a piece in the Financial Times today to promote this study, and basically it's saying that they're even going as far as saying the IRS should change the tax laws to make for-profit, privately owned newspapers basically tax-free run as a nonprofit. That they have to rely more on foundation money and public financing. Now, this is an indictment of privately owned newspapers. It has obviously not worked. The business has collapsed, and they're in a denial. The way a lot of people in the administration may be in denial about what's going on in Afghanistan, I find that the newspaper industry is in denial about its own role and its own demise. They're blaming it too much, I think, on the internet and bloggers. And that's kind of pitiful when you think about that. They have made the huge mistakes over the last 20 years or so of spending millions and millions of dollars, here and in Europe as well, on consultants, newspaper consultants, to come in and tell them how they should run their paper. And what they essentially did was disinvest from the newsroom, fire reporters, and spend money on puzzles and entertainment news and celebrity gossip, and the people don't want that stuff. That's the way you're going to sell newspapers. Well, guess what? It hasn't worked. In the end, of the paper industry is collapsing for a lot of other reasons, too. But that's a major one. That was a wrong strategy. They have to admit that. And the consequences of that have been there was a contempt, really, for the public. I think that they were looking at the public in a much more negative way and thinking they're too stupid to care about what's going on in government and in business. And therefore, the Guardian traditional role of the press as the guardian and the protector of the people, this may sound corny as hell, but I still believe this, sorry, to protect the people from abuses of power by men and women in government and in private industry, is fading away because they didn't fund the reporters who do that job. They took all the money for themselves. They enriched themselves, the consultants, and watered down the newspaper. And through mergers to so many few radio stations and news departments and newspapers exist. And this is this has come home to roost, all of this strategy now. And now we are where we're at right now. And we've got, on the one hand, a mainstream media where you have skilled, experienced, talented, and knowledgeable reporters who know how to get the news, how to evaluate facts, and how to write it, on the one hand, but they don't have the money, anymore to do the kind of in-depth reporting that gets below what I call the surface politics, which is what you get mostly in newspaper, which is a bill in Congress, a speech, campaign news, which is all important, but you never, ever really get to the kinds of efforts to look into deep politics. And the only time the real deep politics break to the surface and become part of the news is when there's a coup, when there's an assassination, when there's an invasion, when there's an economic collapse, when there's a company that collapses. Then where was the business press looking into what was going on in Wall Street and analyzing what the deregulation had meant? Where was the press looking into all these companies that falsified their earnings sheets back in the early part of the last decade, of this decade, rather? Where was the press with the invasion of Iraq, the most glaring example? But there are many. They did not look into what was really happening until it was too late. And that's a function, again, of two things. No money there, and the fact that too many American reporters believe this is American exceptionalism, and that we are people who are pure, or we're good. We don't do that. We're the good guys. It's kind of silly idea that we can't be corrupt. Despite Iran-Contra and Watergate and so many other examples, and the lies leading into the invasion of Iraq, there's still a persistent feeling that America doesn't commit war crimes, America is not a corrupt country, so we can't possibly even have the imagination to look into these kinds of stories. So you've got the bloggers coming who do look into these kinds of stories. And they bring in the citizen element, the democratic element of the citizens' voices being heard, but they lack the skills and the experience and the ability to do journalism. They're not professional journalists for the most part. So I'm saying, I argue, we've got to combine the two. We need that kind of energy and that democratic spirit and that willingness to challenge this myth of American exceptionalism that many bloggers bring. I want to look into stories that the mainstream media will not cover for lack of money or because of their own denial about what American, what kinds of things could be going wrong in our country, and somehow combine the two strengths of this, save journalism, and fund it now in a publicly funded way with foundations. So this, out of this crisis could come an opportunity, maybe, for a new kind of a press. God, we need it. We really need it. And maybe we got all the elements here that I've just described here.
Now, Joe, I'm going to let Sibel in a moment take on the issue of bloggers because she's had uneven experiences there. But I agree with much of what you said about those who own newspapers and their failures. You make it a very interesting point about the consultants. I don't think most people are aware of that, and I don't think it's talked about very often. And I don't believe that it's simply a fact that Craigslist killed the classified ads, and that's why the industry is on its knees. However, Craigslist did have a huge impact, particularly on the San Jose Mercury News and, in turn, the Knight Ridder chain, because Silicon Valley was pumping that paper full of classified ads all through the 80s and 90s and hit the wall as we turned the century. The other point that I would make is that we've seen a generational change in the owners at the Washington Post, the Louisville Courier-Journal, here at the San Francisco Chronicle. The family that owned it for years basically gave up and finally sold the paper to the Hearst Corporation because they wanted to buy more Lexuses and have more corporate jets. So there has been, I think, a failure of stewardship as the generational torch was passed. And I think that that's epitomized by a bottom feeder like Sam Zell taking control of the Tribune Company, which includes the Los Angeles Times, two great, formerly great newspapers that he has gutted. And he larded those companies up with huge debt that he cannot service anymore. And he did it without a dime of his own cash. It was just amazing.
Yeah. Well, it's a public trust, owning a newspaper. It is not any old business. And it has to be run that way. And by and large, the family era of newspaper ownership, it was in general more of a civic responsibility of the family to the public through their newspaper as a vehicle. And that's lost when corporations took over, people like Zell, where it was just about, and they looked at it as any other business, just to make a profit and to feed the shareholders. Even when things were going well in the newspaper business 10 years ago, they were firing reporters. Profits were at 23% margin, and they fired reporters because they were giving the money to the consultants who were telling them to fire the reporters. And look what's happened. And you're absolutely right about Craigslist. I mean, the Internet can give all the movie timetables, the stock results, the classified, but they can't give right now the kind of investigative journalism the newspaper business used to give. So that's why those two things have to combine. But, I mean, it's your ownership is they don't want to admit it. You know, we criticize others in journalism. That's our job. Sometimes somebody's got to, who's going to criticize us as journalists and then the owners? You know, that doesn't exist really.
That's a very good point. And let's go back to the blogs, and the blogs that are trying to sell themselves as news sites. And I'll invite you, both you and Peter, name any of the successful ones. I'll bring it up on the screen right here on my computer to show you that a lot of them, what they do is they are recycling the mainstream media's headlines. And as I'm just telling you, just name one, and I can bring it up, and we can start hitting these, okay? It may be Oberman and who was the guest or what was the topic and how he talked about it, and there is a video. I have one right now in front of me. I'm not going to name it at this point. Yep. Mm-hmm. Then under it, there is a news taken. There's a piece taken from CBS news site, and there is just an added intro, very small. The title has been changed. And in the middle of the second paragraph, they're saying the source is CBS News. I don't see any really original investigative work.
No.
In most of these sites, they are selling garbage.
Well, let me.
And they are selling themselves as the progressive news media sites, but they are stealing stuff. I really see that. First of all, it's really unethical. They are stealing stuff from the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. They just add their own flavor to it. No investigative work. Or they are yakking based on partisanship, whether it's the ultra-right or the ultra-left, and attacking the other side. You know, one is attacking Ann Coulter. The other one is attacking, who is this woman, Rochelle Maddow. And it's just, it's obscene. I really haven't come across a site that I consider a viable, trustworthy, a news blog news site.
All right, I want to mention three.
okay, please.
ProPublica is an interesting new model, and it is funded by money that came from a savings and loan here in California that specialized in subprime loans. That's kind of an ugly source of the money. But the husband and wife team, the Sandlers, have put a bunch of money into ProPublica. They've hired professional journalists, and they're doing original reporting. Now, they back into partnerships with corporate media outlets for distribution, but I do respect the reporting that they're doing. Secondly, Robert Parry's site, consortiumnews.com, does a good job of original reporting and commentary. And my friend Jason Leopold started the Public Record, and he does a lot of original investigative reporting on very important issues and doesn't just recycle corporate media stuff. But that said, these are the exceptions, Sibel.
These are the exceptions. I completely agree with you, but they are not news sites. I mean, they pick a very small niche focus area, which is great, okay? That means people have to go and visit many, many, many sites to get, let's say, when you go and get your Washington Post and New York Times, hopefully you haven't paid for it, and you go through it, you do have different areas. You have the editorials, you have the section on Europe and in South America and on Africa. So basically, you don't have to go and buy 15 newspapers to fulfill of getting the overall news needs you have. Of course, you can go to Google News and see the headlines. That's mm-hmm. something you can do. But they're not news sites. It's and also, even though I have great respect, like I like Bob Parry and I have all his books and I'm a frequent visitor, they don't have big followers. Okay,
that's
they're suffering financially mm-hmm. big time. They're suffering. Number two is it's very, very extremely partisan. Okay. And that itself, and it gets to be known and then marginalized as partisan, then you do lose credibility because it's good to just be as neutral as possible. Nobody is 100% neutral, but partisanship plays a big role with many of these sites. Now,
right.
I want to ask Joe's opinion.
Please, Joe.
Joe.
There was one other you could mention, GlobalPost.com. I don't know if you know that. It started by Charlie Sennett, a guy I knew at the Boston Globe, and the Globe shut its foreign desk down. And that has been a real problem, shutting down foreign bureaus and foreign desks at a time when there are American troops fighting a couple of wars overseas, and we're not getting foreign news anymore. And he started this with a cable TV magnate up in Boston at GlobalPost.com. They do only foreign stories. I've written a couple of stories for him already, so I'm starting to write for him. And they're doing a pretty good job, but Sibel's right. Those are aggregates. I mean, the Huffington Post, like Matt Drudge. Look at Matt Drudge. He's got hardly anything that's original.
Yeah.
But he pulls out interesting stories that you may not find, and that serves a useful purpose. Like Google News does, rather, and Huffington Post. And Drudge gives you a menu of stories that link you to the websites of those particular publications, which is why they let them get away with putting them out there, because that drives traffic to their own site. But as far as I mean, someday, Sibel, I think what's going to happen is there probably won't be print newspapers. I mean, there are already a couple of examples. I think the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and the Christian Science Monitor have gone fully online. So that, you could say, is an online news site that does original reporting. So there are a couple of those former newspapers that are only online news sites right now. And you need enormous amounts of money. You talked about the New York Times has their world section in sports.
Right.
It's a huge, huge operation, and they make not have a print edition someday either, and then there'll be only an online site with original news. That seems to be where we're definitely going to. But we're at the beginning of this transition. We're in the middle of a huge change, and it looks very messy right now, and it's troubling because it's a big crisis. But we're seeing this happening. We're seeing more and more sites are going to go only online and have original news in them. But the issue is whether the public, you know, you call this boiling frogs, which is interesting, because does the public realize that this is happening? Are they going to wake up one day and there are going to be no more newspapers? And they're going to miss it. And they're going to realize that they need newspapers. They've taken it for granted. Everybody takes a newspaper for granted, don't they?
Maybe the generational difference. I don't know. When you're looking at the, you know, iPod carriers and the BlackBerry carriers, when they don't want to sit down and read the in-depth, you know, coverage, which is a pity. Because we have a much shorter attention span with the new generation that we had and we have with older generation. The new generation wants it quick. They want hot news. They want big title. But they don't want to scroll and read or go through pages of newspaper and read. Don't you see some generational differences there?
I do think that without question that they are not reading print newspaper, the physical paper. anymore, and that's probably why that's going to be driven out, especially as well as the great distribution costs, the paper costs involved in producing a newspaper. And Murdoch made a statement a couple of weeks ago that he's looking forward to that day because then he won't have to pay print unions anymore either. No more
yeah, so, he'll move out of Whopping.
Yeah, he said that Whopping, shut down Whopping, put the whole thing online. But I can't say that young people, there are all, you know, young, there are very smart young people that I've met who read in depth. They may be reading online in depth, or they're, you know, and books are going to go online, which really I find personally a terrible thing, and I hope I live long enough to still see books, physical books being printed and sold in bookshops. But you can't say that young people are not looking in depth, although you do get that impression when you look at Twitter and these things where it's the attention span, I mean, it keeps getting shorter and shorter. But in general, I think we can't pronounce anything definite about what's happening here. And I think there are positive signs. And the signs I was talking about was public funding of the papers. And maybe there's going to be a shift now that the bloggers have had a positive influence, that they're out there and they seem to be a threat to the mainstream papers. Because if you're on the same platform and you can get it for free, I know a lot of people tell me, I don't read the New York Times. I only read the bloggers. And I say, well, it's probably better if you try to read both. Certainly, you can't rely just on bloggers to get the news. So there is that sense that the bloggers have are on a level playing field with the New York Times, which would have been an absurd notion 5 years ago. But this is where we're at right now. And how it plays out is going to be extremely interesting. There's no question.
Well, Joe, I want to thank you for joining us for a lively conversation. I appreciate your insight on international issues in the United Nations and Afghanistan. And it's also great to talk to you about media here in the U.S. Joe Lauria, thanks for joining us here on The Boiling Frogs.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.